Okay, our next case is 2019-655, the State of Ohio versus Kyle Patrick. For the appellant, we have Mr. Juhas.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, good morning. Chief Justice, if I may, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. May it please the court, Kyle Patrick was 17 years old when these offenses were committed. Now, the law is pretty clear that we can try juveniles as adults, but the law is equally clear that we cannot sentence juveniles as adult. Kyle, in this case, was bound over by a mandatory bind over and was tried as an adult. And the record is clear, he was sentenced as an adult in this case. Yet everything about the Eighth Amendment jurisprudence says that he cannot be sentenced as an adult. The question here is whether a court can sentence any juvenile to any life offense without first doing what the Eighth Amendment commands. Now, the state in this case obviously has argued the horrendous facts of the case. We see that in all of the cases from Roper on down. It says that what we are doing is making policy arguments and even talks about the original intent of the Eighth Amendment and the Ohio Constitution. All of us survey the case law, but what the state doesn't do and what we think is the central premise here is there a principled way to distinguish this life sentence, or indeed any life sentence for any juvenile who's tried as an adult? And no reason, is there a reason not to impose the Miller, consider the Miller factors before imposing a sentence? We say that there is no principled reason, and that's why the Eighth Amendment commands what did not happen in this case. There's been some effort in the briefs to distinguish this case because it is not an LWOP case. It is not a life without parole case. The appellants Amici, the juvenile leagues, cite some of the statutes from the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, talking about whether it's likely that a juvenile would get parole, even if there's a possibility of parole. But the point for this appeal is that from the vantage of 2017, when this sentence was imposed, or from the vantage point of today in 2020, that this is a sentence that legally could have Kyle Patrick leaving the institution in a pine box. There is simply no way to determine. And so in that respect, yes, sir.
Let me ask you this. Is it your position that the sentencing record is just too void to suggest that the trial court judge in any way considered the youth of the defendant in this case? Do you concede that are there any facts that had the trial court judge placed them on the record that would support the more severe sentence that was handed out in this case? We're talking about, in this case, they're all life sentences, right? We're talking about when the defendant would first arrive at the parole board for consideration for release. So even the plea bargain that the state offered originally, he would have hit the parole board at 16 years. Okay. So the government and ODRC always retains the right, if they think he's a public safety risk, to keep him in prison for the rest of his life on all of these sentences. So my question is, are you saying that there is absolutely no facts that this trial court judge could have laid out for a reviewing court and to justify the more severe sentence in this case?
I hope I'm answering your question. There is the possibility of a more severe sentence than the minimum sentence, but the record in this case does not disclose that. So to answer your question, Justice Donnelly, about are there facts, there may have been facts one way or the other. All those things, you know, we talk, all of us in our briefs, we use the shorthand term youth, but it isn't just the question of age, because of course his age was brought up. What wasn't brought up are all the things that Miller and the other cases say go with age, the impetuousness, the reckless behavior, the peer pressure. None of those things are before the trial court, so the trial court could not have considered them. And I think that one of the biggest things that indicates why that's true, this trial ended with a verdict on 4:30 in the afternoon on a Friday, and this appellant was sentenced on Monday morning at 9 a.m. without a pre-sentence investigation. So there just aren't those things in the record for the judge to have considered.
Counselor, can you address the arguments raised by the state of Ohio that we should IA this case because there's a threshold jurisdictional issue that no one's addressed?
I can, and the first thing I guess I would say is waiver applies. There's case law from this court that waiver applies.
If we don't have jurisdiction, you can't waive that, can we?
Well, as I understand the state's argument, there's no jurisdiction because this sentence is not reviewable. And what I'm saying is that this sentence, that argument was not made in the Court of Appeals below, so the argument can't be asserted here as a basis not to review the sentence. So I would say that, first of all. Secondly, I would say that.
Well, but again, that's a question. That would be a question of whether or not that statute goes to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. If it goes to subject matter jurisdiction of the court, the state could waive it any time. We really haven't had any briefing or discussion of that.
That's true. There hasn't been any briefing, and the state does cite a case where the court on its own decides to take notice of an issue that wasn't raised in the Court of Appeals. I would stick by my waiver argument, but in addition to that, I would say that the statute that the state is citing plainly is not an apposite for a couple of reasons. First of all, the statute itself by its own terms says that a sentence for aggravated murder is not reviewable under this section. And I understand and respect what this court and the other courts have had to say. I have to disagree with that, that it's not with the conclusion that it's not reviewable at all. It simply says specifically it's not reviewable under this section. If you think about the logical corollary of that, any aggravated murder sentence in this state that wasn't a capital sentence would be precluded from review if you read the statute as the state wants you to read it. Secondly, I would also say about that, Justice DeWine, that we're not directly challenging the sentence, because going back to what Justice Donnelly asked, we don't really have the information to be able to make that intelligent challenge, much like the situation in State v. Long. This is simply a situation where the record isn't there, where the record doesn't indicate whether or not youth and all of those things that Miller says are attendant to it were even considered. I would submit this case is a little bit worse than Long, because in Long, at the time the trial judge considered sentence, Miller had not been decided. Here, Miller had been decided several years before the sentencing, in this case in 2017, which to me highlights the error of simply not considering those Miller factors.
Also, I want to address your statements that age just wasn't considered at all. I mean, don't we have some evidence in the record? For example, his mother testified and talked about, you know, this was just a matter of him being young and following the wrong crowd. We even had the prosecutor that saying that we need to do something different here because of his age. You know, don't we at least have some indication that the judge had all of those factors in front of it at the time?
Well, Your Honor, you have some indication in the sense that, just like in Long, where the judge, I think, sat through a much longer trial. If I recall, that was about a 4-week trial. This was just a several day trial. And so the argument by the state was, well, the judge knew the age of the defendant. And sure, the judge here knew the age of the defendant. And yes, his mother made some comments about it. But that is an entirely different situation from making a full presentation, which I argue that defense counsel should have done, and the trial court should frankly have demanded under Miller, to look into these matters a little more deeply rather than making that.
Even though here we had defense counsel talking about his youth, we had the prosecutor talking about his youth. So what kind of a hearing would you expect?
Well, I might expect a more detailed hearing on, we don't know if the mother made reference to drugs. You know, the state's position was that this was a robbery gone bad. The mother's position, and to the extent that Kyle Patrick revealed anything through his lawyer, was this was a drug deal. So, and the mother talked about how bad drugs were. We don't know anything about the appellant's history. We don't know anything about his family, one of the things that Miller says we should take into consideration. We know from the record that these three kids who he was with were all older than him. We don't really know anything about the peer pressure. And those are the things that Miller suggests should be addressed. And if I may just to go back and answer the other part of your question about
counsel,
the state.
Before you leave that part of the question, are you suggesting that in these type of cases, there has to be expert opinion?
I'm not, Chief Justice.
Okay, what are you saying? What could be the source of this information that you just outlined?
Well, for example, in Long, there were sentencing memoranda. Now, the opinion doesn't indicate whether there were things attached to it, but let's go back to this issue that I was talking about, Mr. Patrick's drug usage. Certainly, you could get, as would be done with a pre-sentence investigation, you could get those sort of records. You wouldn't necessarily need a psychologist to come in, but you could have parents and family members come in, school teachers come in to talk about peer pressure, that sort of thing. A fuller sentencing hearing than certainly was done here to address those Miller factors. And to go back to what Justice French asked you, talking about the state raised age, the state raised it in sort of a left-handed fashion. They cited this court's decision in the Brandon Moore case and basically said, Judge, we really want you to give this guy life without parole. But since the Supreme Court said in the Brandon Moore case that you have to give him, and I think her words from the transcript were, some shot at parole somewhere out there, then we're asking you to do the next tick down, which in this case was 30 to life, or with the gun spec, 33 to life. And our position is that you don't circumvent the Eighth Amendment and everything that Roper and Miller and Graham and Brandon Moore, all those cases say have to be done with the Eighth Amendment. You don't circumvent that simply by ticking it down one sentence.
Let me ask you about Miller. You keep citing Miller, but wasn't really the thrust of Miller that the problem in Miller was the mandatory nature of the sentence precluded the judge from considering age at all? Whereas here, we don't have that problem. This doesn't seem to be like Miller at all.
I would agree with you and not agree with you. I would certainly agree with you that Miller did involve a mandatory life sentence, and that was one of the problems that the court had with it. But Justice Kagan talked about the fact that nothing that the court had said up to the point in time in Miller was crime specific. And if you look at everything the court has said, going back from Thompson, when they said you can't execute 16-year-olds, through Roper, through Graham, through Miller, everything the court has said is juveniles are different. They have a lesser sense of moral culpability. We have to take these into account. And so we submit that this case is the next logical step. Certainly Miller talked about a mandatory life sentence, but here the judge still had to choose from four very different options. And we concede, by the way, that life without parole is theoretically one of the things that he still could impose. The state asked him not to do that, but the prior decision of this court in Long, I think, says that's not off the table. The point of the diatribe here is that the judge didn't have the information necessary to make a meaningful choice between one of those options that the statute gave him upon the return of the verdict. So it is our position, and we know what all those factors are, and they all were not considered here and could have been considered. It's our position the Eighth Amendment doesn't stop when it comes to juveniles at the death penalty, and it doesn't stop at life without parole. And so I'm going to reserve, if I may, unless there are other questions, the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rivera.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Ralph Rivera on behalf of the state of Ohio and Mahoning County Prosecutor's Office. I will be splitting my time with Diane Bray from the Attorney General's Office. Good morning. As Mr. Juhas pointed out, the issue in this case is specifically whether the Eighth Amendment requires a formal consideration of a use, of an offender's youth if they are sentenced to a life sentence with parole eligibility. and the key factor being formal consideration when the offender has the possibility for parole. Montgomery versus Louisiana clearly answered that question. The Eighth Amendment does not require any formal consideration of an offender's youth. If the trial court imposes a life sentence, that carries with it the possibility for parole. Montgomery clearly stated that even when there is a Miller violation, the remedy for a Miller violation is not a sentencing hearing at all. It is simply the parole eligibility. If this was a case where there was a Miller violation, where there was a life without parole and there was no consideration whatsoever, the Eighth Amendment does not even require a new sentencing hearing. The only thing that the Eighth Amendment requires is the parole eligibility. The answer stops there.
So let me ask you this. Prior to this case going to trial, there was a plea bargain, right?
That's correct.
And the state had a command of all the facts that they eventually proved at the trial, probably more of a command than the trial court judge. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, so the state was okay with, in that plea bargain, the defendant hitting the parole board, receiving a life sentence, but hitting the parole board at 16 years. And the defendant withdrew from that plea agreement and opted to go to trial. What did the state learn, what new facts that weren't available to them, that caused them, after the fact that you convicted him of what you charged him with, to advocate for the most severe time to go before the parole board, and that is 30 to life, rather than 25 or 20 to life? What changed that advocacy?
Well, the simple answer to that is the cold-blooded nature of this murder. The facts as they came out in trial, and they're not necessary, you don't know every single detail, but the key details that were learned through the trial testimony was the fact that upon the victim going upstairs, he was shot immediately upon going upstairs. As his friend testified, there was no struggle upstairs there, to suggest less of a cold-blooded nature. The victim walked upstairs. There was a discussion about a PlayStation and a laptop. He was murdered immediately upon walking up the steps. Now, that is just one of the details that was learned. However,
I wasn't aware of that prior to proceeding to trial.
Well, you're aware of certain facts, but how they specifically come out in trial are completely different to the facts that you may know of certain facts, but you don't know exactly how they're going to come out in trial.
Okay. One more follow-up question. At a sentencing hearing, trial court judges are guided by the overall principles of our sentencing as embodied in 29-29-11-12, and that is to punish the offender, protect the community, rehabilitate the defender if that's even possible, and use the least amount of resources possible to achieve these principles. Don't you think it's incumbent upon trial court judges, if they're going to go, as they did in this case, the most severe and use the most amount of resources, to articulate more reasons why? For instance, they could get a pre-sentence report. They could say, this person has been diagnosed with a behavioral disorder that's not going to be subject to rehabilitation. That's going to present safety issues in the future. Then an appellate court could review that decision and possibly agree with the more severe sentence. Wouldn't that be a better situation than we have?
To answer your question specifically, the trial court did not impose the most severe sanction. Life without parole was a possibility and was and would be the most severe sanction.
And but you told them not to do that for legal reasons, right? At the or your office did.
Well, yeah, I was just to kind of clarify if there's any confusion, I was not trial counsel. I was not involved in any type of pretrial discussions involving this case. But yes, the state did ask for a 30 to life a sentence. I'm not in the mind of that specific prosecutor to tell you exactly why that was asked for. But had the trial court given the life without parole, then the trial court would be required under Long to then state those specific considerations on the record. However, nothing in the Eighth Amendment, nothing in the Eighth Amendment nor the revised code requires the trial court to put any of those factors on the record. Now, of course, as the court stated in Long, yes, the court is guided by 29-29-11 and 29-29-12 in every felony sentencing hearing. They were applicable here. The state is not saying that the trial court should ignore any considerations regarding youth or any specific factors that a defense counsel or the state advocates at a sentencing hearing. Our position is that the Eighth Amendment does not require formal findings on the record as the court held in Long. This court in Long and the United States Supreme Court in Montgomery clearly drew that line at life without parole. Anything below life without parole satisfies the Eighth Amendment. And again, every Ohio appellate court that has dealt with this issue has followed that line of thinking. If the sentencing court is imposing anything less than life without parole, those formal considerations are not required to be placed on the record. Of course, again, those considerations, and from the case law through the appellate courts and this court, the considerations under 29-29-11 and 29-29-12, which include an offender's youth, are presumed from the record. A silent record presumes that those considerations were considered, and the trial court considered all of the arguments that the state made, all of the arguments that the defendant made. In this case, the defense counsel did put on the record, made arguments regarding his youth, his immaturity. Certainly, as counsel spoke, his mother spoke to his immaturity, spoke to that he was just a follower, he wasn't a leader. The trial court is presumed to have taken those things into consideration. And kind of just a point to the court's judgment entry, the trial court's judgment entry clearly states that he did take into consideration both 29-29-11 and 29-29-12. Kind of touching upon the overall theme of Graham and Miller and Moore and Long, those were cases where the juvenile offender had no possibility of parole. They had no possibility of release. The concerns were when you incarcerate a juvenile without the possibility of parole, you're assuming that rehabilitation is impossible. You're assuming that that specific offender does not have the ability to change. As the court talks about, life without parole is reserved for those rare juvenile offenders that are completely irredeemable. Those issues are concerns. Those concerns are not present in this case. They're not present because Mr. Patrick, regardless if it's after 20 or 25 or 30, he still has the possibility of parole. And Montgomery made clear, once a juvenile offender is eligible for parole, the Eighth Amendment is satisfied. I would like to reserve, if I could, the remaining time for Ms. Bray.
Counsel.
Thank you. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'd like to begin by addressing one of the points that opposing counsel made at the beginning of his argument about saying that there's no principled way to distinguish between this life sentence and the other life sentences that were a possibility here. And we would beg to differ. We'd say this distinguishing feature is the possibility of parole, which Mr. Patrick got. As my co-counsel has pointed out, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Montgomery case said, in fact, that the remedy for a Miller violation was consideration for parole at some point. And if it is the remedy for a Miller violation, then it stands to reason that a sentence that provides the possibility for parole consideration is not a Miller violation to begin with. In fact, the state's rule provides a more clear rule here for the court, and that is that if a juvenile sentence provides for the possibility of parole well within the juvenile's lifetime, that satisfies the Eighth Amendment and Article 1, Section 9 of the Ohio Constitution.
Counsel, the way I understand the appellant's argument, it's not so much whether this was an appropriate, whether the, in the abstract, this sentence was available to the court to impose here. It's the fact that there is no basis that can be identified that the judge considered when imposing this sentence with this length of time before the parole board. So it's not an argument whether under no circumstances can this sentence with these configurations be imposed. It's just that the court needs to do more.
Your Honor, I think Mr. Rivera said it well when he said that, as this court said in Long and some other cases, that you look at the age and age-related factors as a constitutional matter when there's a life without parole sentence for the juvenile. And here it was one of the discretionary sentences that was a lesser option than that. And so that those Eighth Amendment requirements don't apply here.
So you're saying that the court does not have to take into consideration youth or any of the other ramifications of youth?
Certainly not any findings on the record. And in fact, in this case, as Mr. Rivera pointed out, there was consideration of that, given that the both counsel at sentencing presented argument on the age and age-related factors issue. In the sense that they talked about it, and the mother talked specifically about her thoughts about it and the maturity in her view of her son. So this was before the court. The court recited in its sentencing entry that he had considered the factors that he needed to consider. So this is simply, it's not a case where no consideration was given to it, but as a constitutional matter, that heightened requirement applies for life without parole, but we would say does not apply to these lower sentences. And it makes sense if you think about it. I mean, what would be the distinguishing feature to say that, well, okay, if the line isn't life without parole, then is it the 30-year, life with 30 years? Is it life with 25 years or 20? Is it a 20-year sentence? Is it a 15-year sentence? I mean, we don't know. There's no objective, principled way to draw that line other than the line that is already drawn for us with the Miller and Montgomery cases, which is at life without parole.
So are you saying that when a youth is before the court on a serious felony such as this, there is no requirement to employ the Miller factors. And youth in and of itself is not sufficient to trigger a different scrutiny than you would in adult sentencing?
Well, it's certainly one of the factors that can be considered, as this court said very clearly in Long, that it's age and age-related factors. It's one other consideration in applying and choosing the right sentence as a matter of the sentencing court's discretion. But Long also said that it doesn't mean that that factor has to be given a particular weight as part of the sentencing. It does not, in other words, dictate the result. And
I don't think the opposing counsel is saying it dictates the result. He said this may be an appropriate sentence. They're not taking the sentence off the table. He's just saying, you know, that the sufficiency of the sentence or the propriety of the sentence would have been clear had the judge articulated his considerations here?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree in that the judge, we presume that he considered what was presented to him, and it certainly was presented to him. And the Miller and Long and Montgomery cases say that if you have a Miller violation, parole is the remedy, and parole was part of this sentence from the day it was imposed. And so therefore it satisfies any constitutional concerns. And moreover, in terms of the state constitutional provision, Article 1, Section 9, that was not argued specifically in the brief and was abandoned here. So to the extent there's any separate consideration, there's no need for the court to do that in this case. For all these reasons, we respectfully ask the court to affirm or to improv this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel.
May it please the court. So if I understand the state's argument here, the Eighth Amendment doesn't apply because a judge has to predetermine what sentence he's going to impose. It's only if he decides that he's going to impose a life sentence without parole before the sentencing hearing starts that he doesn't have to take into consideration all of the Miller factors. If he decides that it's some sentence that's authorized by law but less than LWOP, then he doesn't have to consider any of the factors. I would say a couple things about the state's argument about Montgomery. First of all, the case is mostly about retroactivity, but secondly, to the extent that the case is about parole being a remedy for a Miller violation, indeed it is a remedy for a Miller violation because Miller involved a mandatory LWOP sentence. So of course parole is the remedy. What we're saying here is just what I said a moment ago, that it makes no sense under the Eighth Amendment not to consider these factors. These factors are the things that the courts have said go into the less culpability and the redeemability. So it should factor into which of the four sentences the judge chose. And I see I'm out of time, and I thank the court.
Counsel, I have a question. You start off with their pine box argument. I want to follow up a little bit. Are you saying the Miller factors have to be considered every time a youth is sentenced on any basis?
No, I'm saying that the Miller factors have to be considered. I think the court's already said that's not the case, that felony sentences are okay. I'm saying that the Miller factors have to be considered when it's a life sentence. That's our proposition in this court, and that's all we're urging this court to find.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.